Hello, everyone. We're continuing on with Thomas Manton, an exposition with notes upon the Epistle of James. We're on. We're going to do verse 2 here, Lord willing, here for this session. And so we'll go ahead and begin. This is James 1, verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations. So he goes through and he explains the words, and then he goes into his observations. My brethren, a usual compilation in the scriptures and very frequent in this epistle, partly because of the manner of the Jews who were wont or often to call all their nation brethren, and partly because of the manner of the ancient Christians, who in courtesy used to call the men and women of their society and communion brothers and sisters, and partly out of apostolical kindness, in that the exhortation might be seasoned with the more love and goodwill. Count it, that is, though sense will not find it so, yet in spiritual judgment you must so esteem it, all joy, that is, matter of chief joy. All is used in the writings of the apostles, as in 1 Timothy 1:15, worthy of all acceptation, that is, of chief acceptation. When ye fall, the word signifies such troubles as come up upon us unawares, as sudden things do most discompose the mind. But however, says the apostle, when ye fall and are suddenly circumvented, yet you must look upon it as a trial and matter of great joy. For though it seems a chance to us, yet it falls under the ordination of God. Divers, the Jewish nation was infamous and generally hated, especially the Christian Jews, who, besides the scorn of the heathen, were exercised with sundry injuries, or lots of injuries, rapines, and spoils from their own brethren and people of their own nation, as appears by the Epistle of Peter, who wrote to the same persons that our apostle does, our apostle here, James, and also speaks of diverse or manifold temptations, 1 Peter 1:6. And again by the epistle to the Hebrews, written also to these dispersed tribes, see Hebrews 10:34, ye took joyfully the spoiling of your goods, that is, by the fury of the multitude and base people against whom the Christians could have no right. And then temptations, so diverse temptations, so he calls afflictions, which to believers are of that use and habitude. The observations are these. Observation 1, my brethren, Christians are linked to one another in the bond of the brotherhood. It was an ancient use, as I've showed before, for Christians of the same communion to call one another brothers and sisters, which gave occasion of scorn to the heathen then. Latin from Tertullian, and it is still made a matter of reproach. What scoff more usual than that of holy brethren? If we will not keep up the title, yet the affection which becomes the relation should not cease. We may not call each other that, but the affection that that title has with it should not cease. The term hints duty to all sorts of Christians, meekness to those that excel in gifts or office, that they may not be stately and disdainful to the meanest or lowest in the body of Christ. It is Christ's own argument, ye are brethren, Matthew 23:8. And it also suggests love and mutual amity. Who should love more than those that are united in the same head and hope? Latin from Augustine said of himself and his friend Alypius, that is, cemented with the same blood of Christ. That's what Augustine said, cemented with the same blood of Christ. We are all traveling homeward and expect to meet in the same heaven. It would be sad that brethren should fall out of the way. Genesis 45, verse 24. It was once said, see how the Christians love one another. But alas, now we may say, see how they hate one another. Observation 2. From that, count it, Miseries are sweet or bitter according as we will reckon of them. Seneca said, our grief lies in our own opinion and apprehensions of miseries. I think Seneca was a heathen writer. Spiritual things are worthy in themselves. Other things depend upon our opinion and valuation of them. Well, then, it stands us much upon to make a right judgment. Therein lies our misery or comfort. Things are according as you will count them. That your judgments may be rectified in this point of afflictions, take these rules. Number one, do not judge by sense. Hebrews 12:11, no affliction for the present seemeth joyous, but grievous, etc. Theophylact observed that in this passage, two words are emphatical, for the present and seemeth. For the present notes the feeling and experience of sense, and seemeth the apprehension and dictate of it. Sense can feel no joy in it, and sense will suggest nothing but bitterness and sorrow, but we are not to go by that count and reckoning. A Christian lives above the world because he does not judge according to the world. Paul's scorn of all sublunary accidents arose from his spiritual judgment concerning them. Romans 8:18, I reckon that the sufferings of this present world are not worthy to be compared with the joys that shall be revealed in us. Sense, that is altogether for present things, would judge quite otherwise. But, says the apostle, I reckon, i.e. reason, by another manner of rule and account. So Hebrews 11:26, it is said that Moses esteemed the reproach of Christ better than the treasures of Egypt. His choice, you see, was founded in his judgment and esteem. Number two, judge by a supernatural light. Christ's eye salve must clear your sight, or else you cannot make a right judgment. There is no proper and fit apprehension of things till you get within the veil and see by the light of a sanctuary lamp. 1 Corinthians 2:11, the things of God knoweth no man but by the Spirit of God. He had said before in, I guess, 1 Corinthians 2:9, eye hath not seen, ear hath not heard, etc., i.e., natural senses do not perceive the worth and price of spiritual privileges. For I suppose the apostle speaks not there of the incapacity of our understandings to conceive of heavenly joys, but of the unsuitableness of spiritual objects to carnal senses. A man that has no other light but reason and nature cannot judge of those things. God's riddles, to tell a riddle, are only open to those that plow with God's heifer. And it is by God's Spirit that we come to discern and esteem the things that are of God, which is the main drift of the apostle in that chapter. So David, Psalm 36:9, in thy light we shall see light. That is, by his Spirit, we come to discern the brightness of glory or grace and the nothingness of the world. Number three, judge by supernatural grounds. Many times common grounds may help us to discern the lightness of our grief, yea, carnal grounds. Your counting must be a holy counting. Those in the prophet said, the bricks are fallen, but we will build with hewn stones. Isaiah 9:10. It is a misery, but we know how to remedy it. So many despise their troubles. We can repair and make up this loss again, or know how to deal well enough with this misery. All this is not a right judgment, but vain thoughts. So the prophet calls their carnal debates and reasonings. In Jeremiah 4:14, how long shall vain thoughts lodge with thee? That is, carnal shifts and contrivances by which they despised the judgment rather than improved it. True judging and counting always follows some spiritual discourse and reasoning and is the result of some principle of faith or patience. As thus, it is a misery, but God will turn it to our good. That's an example. God's corrections are sharp, but we have strong corruptions to be mortified. We are called to great trials, but we may reckon upon great hopes. etc. So those are ways to look at the judgment in a positive spiritual way. Observation three, from that, so we recount it, and now it's all joy. Afflictions to God's people do not only minister occasion of patience, but great joy. The world has no reason to think religion a black and gloomy way. As the apostle says, the weakness of Christ is stronger than the strength of men, 1 Corinthians 1:25. So grace's worst is better than the world's best. All joy when in diverse trials. A Christian is a bird that can sing in winter as well as in spring. He can live in the fire like Moses' burning bush, burn and not be consumed, nay, leap in the fire. The counsel of the text is not a paradox, fitted only for notion and discourse, or some strain and reach of fancy, but an observation built upon a common and known experience. This is the fashion and manner of believers to rejoice in their trials. Thus, in Hebrews 10, verse 34, ye took the spoiling of your goods joyfully. In the midst of rifling and plundering, and the incivilities of rude and violent men, they were joyful and cheerful. The apostle goes one step higher, 2 Corinthians 7, verse 4, I am exceeding joyful in all your tribulation. Mark that Greek words, I superabound or overflow in joy. So superabound in joy and overflow in joy. Certainly a dejected spirit lives much beneath the height of Christian privileges and principles. Paul, in his worst estate, felt an exuberancy of joy. I am exceeding joyful. Nay, you shall see in another place he went higher yet. Romans 10, verse 3, we glory in tribulations. It notes the highest joy, joy with a boasting and exultation, such a ravishment as cannot be compressed. Certainly a Christian is the world's wonder, and there is nothing in their lives but what men will count strange. Their whole course is a riddle, which the multitude understands not, 2 Corinthians 6:10, as sorrowful yet always rejoicing. It is Paul's riddle, and maybe every Christian's motto and symbol. Objection number one, but you will say, does not the scripture allow us a sense of our condition? How can we rejoice in that which is evil? Christ's soul was heavy unto death. Solution. I answer, number one, not barely in the evil of them, that is so far from being a fruit of grace that it is against nature. There is a self, John 12, verse 27, my soul is troubled, what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, etc. As a private person, Christ would manifest the same affections that are in us, though as mediator, he freely chose death and sufferings. The mere evil is grievous, the evil itself. Besides, in the sufferings of Christ, there was a concurrence of our guilt taken into his own person and of God's wrath. And it is a known rule, uses Latin. No adversary but God can make us miserable. And it is his wrath that puts a vinegar and gall into our sufferings and not man's. This is solution number two. Their joy is from the happy effects or consequence or comforts occasioned by the sufferings. And I will name some. Number one, the honor done to us, that we are singled out to bear witness to the truths of Christ. To you it is given to suffer, Philippians 1:29. It is a gift and an act of free grace. To be called to such special service is an act of God's special favor, and so far from being a matter of discouragement, that it is a ground of thanksgiving. 1 Peter 4, verse 16, if any man suffer as a Christian, let him glorify God in this behalf. Not accuse God by murmuring thoughts, but glorify him. This consideration had an influence upon the primitive saints and martyrs. It is said in Acts 5, verse 41, that they went away rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer for Christ. In the original, that they were honored to be dishonored for Christ. It is a great dignity and honor put upon us to be drawn out before angels and men as champions for God and his truth. And this will warrant our joy. So Christ himself in Matthew 5, verse 12, when men say all manner of evil against you falsely, and for my name's sake, rejoice and be exceeding glad. Luke has it, rejoice and leap for joy, Luke 6, 23, which notes such excellency of affection as is stirred up by some sudden and great comfort. That's how it should be. As if you were suddenly stirred up by a great comfort, that would be the joy in your sufferings. And because it's an honor done to us. Number two, the benefit the church receives. Resolute defenses gain upon the world. The church is like an oak, which lives by its own wounds. And the more limbs are cut off, the more new sprouts. Tertullian says the heathen's cruelty was the great bait and motive by which men were drawn into the Christian religion. And Austin or Augustine reckons up all the methods of destruction by which the heathen sought to suppress the growth of Christianity, but still it grew more. They were bound, butchered, racked, stoned, burned, but still they were multiplying. The church was at first founded in blood, and it thrives best when it is moistened with blood, founded in the blood of Christ, and moistened or watered, as it were, with the blood of the martyrs. Well then, they may rejoice in this, that religion is more propagated, and that their own death and sufferings do any way contribute to the life and flourishing of the church. Number three, their own private and particular comforts. God has consolations proper for martyrs and his children under trials. Let me name a few. Sometimes it is a greater presence in the word. 1 Thessalonians 1:6, ye receive the word with much affliction and joy in the Holy Ghost. Great affliction, but the gospel will counterpoise all. Usually it is a clear evidence and slight of their gracious estate. The sun shines many times when it rains, and they have sweet glimpses of God's favor when their outward condition is most gloomy and sad. When men revile you and persecute you, rejoice, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. Matthew 5, verse 10. God clears up their right and interest, yours, and so distinct hopes and thoughts of glory. Martyrs in the act of suffering and troubles have not only a sight of their interest in Christ, but a sight of the glory of their interest. There are some thoughts stirred up in them which come near to an ecstasy, a happy pre-union of their souls and their blessedness, and such a fore-enjoyment of heaven as gives them a kind of dedolency in the midst of their trials and sufferings. Their minds are so wholly swallowed up, or completely, with the things that are not seen, that they have little thought or sense of the things that are seen, as the apostle seems to intimate in 2 Corinthians 4:18. Again, they rejoice because of their speedy and swifter passage into glory. The enemies do them a courtesy to rid them out of a troublesome world. This made the ancient Christians to rejoice more when they were condemned than absolved, to kiss the stake and thank the executioner because of their earnest desires to be with Christ. So, Justin Martyr, we thank you for delivering us from hard taskmasters, that we may more sweetly enjoy the bosom of Jesus Christ. Objection number two. But some will say, my sufferings are not akin to martyrdom. They come not from the hand of men, but providence or God, and are for my own sins, not for Christ. Solution, I answer, it is true there is a difference between afflictions from the hand of God and persecutions from the violence of men. God's hand is just, and guilt will make the soul less cheerful. But remember, the apostle's word is diverse trials, and sickness, death of friends, and such things as come from an immediate providence, or from God, are but trials to the children of God. In these afflictions, there is required not only mourning and humbling, but a holy courage, H-O-L-Y, a holy courage and confidence. Job 5:22, at destruction and famine shalt thou laugh. There is a holy greatness of mind, H-O-L-Y, holy greatness of mind, and a joy that becomes the saddest providences. Faith should be above all that befalls us. It is its proper work to make a believer triumph over every temporary accident. I guess that would be like a happening in our lives. In ordinary crosses, there are many reasons of laughing and joy. As the fellow feeling of Christ, if you do not suffer for Christ, Christ suffers in you and with you. He is afflicted and touched with the sense of your afflictions. It is an error in believers to think that Christ is altogether unconcerned in their sorrows, unless they be endured for his name's sake, and that the comforts of the gospel are only applicable to martyrdom, which he suggests they're not. Again, another ground of joy in ordinary crosses is because of them we may have such experience of grace, of the love of God, so of grace, of the love of God, and our own sincerity and patience. And that is grounds for rejoicing. Romans 5, verse 3. We rejoice in tribulation, knowing that tribulation worketh patience, and patience experience. The rule holds good in all kinds of tribulations or sufferings. They occasion sweet discoveries of God, and so are a matter of joy. See also 2 Corinthians 12, 9 and 10. I glory in infirmities, and take pleasure in infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. They are happy occasions to discover more of God to us, to give us a greater sense and feeling of the power of grace, and so we may take pleasure in them. Lastly, all evils are alike to faith, and it would as much misbecome a Christian hope to be dejected with losses as with violence and persecution. You should walk so that the world may know you can live above every condition, and that all evils are much beneath your hopes. Well then, from all that has been said, we see that we should with the same cheerfulness suffer the will of Christ as we should suffer for the name of Christ. Observation 4. From that, when ye fall, observe that evils are the better borne when they are undeserved and involuntary. That is, when we fall into them rather than draw them upon ourselves. It was Tertullian's error to say that afflictions were to be sought and desired. The creature never knows when it is well. Sometimes we question God's love because we have no afflictions, and anon because we have nothing but afflictions. In all these things, we must refer ourselves to God's pleasure, not desire troubles, but bear them when he lays them upon us. Christ has taught us to pray, lead us not into temptation. It is but a fond presumption to cast ourselves upon it. Philastrius speaks of some that would compel men to kill them out of an affectation of martyrdom. And so Theodoret, I should be killed so I can be a martyr. This was a mad ambition, not a true zeal. And no less fond are they that seek out crosses and troubles in the world, rather than wait for them, or by their own violence and miscarriages, draw just hatred upon themselves, so by their sin. Peter's rule is, let none of you suffer as an evildoer, 1 Peter 4:15. We lose the comfort of our sufferings when there is guilt in them for our sin. Observation 5, from that diverse. God has several ways wherewith to exercise his people. Diverse miseries come one in the neck of another, as the lunatic in the gospel fell sometimes in the water, sometimes in the fire. So God changes the dispensation, sometimes in this trouble, sometimes in that trouble. Paul gives a catalog of his dangers and sufferings, 2 Corinthians 11, 24 to 28, in perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils of mine own countrymen, in perils by the heathen, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the city, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren. Crosses seldom come singly. When God begins once to try a person, he uses diverse ways of trial, and indeed there is great reason. Diverse diseases must have diverse remedies. pride, envy, covetousness, worldliness, wantonness, ambition are not all cured by the same physic or medicine. Such an affliction pricks the bladder of pride, another checks our desires that are apt to run out in the way of the world, etc. Do not murmur, then, if miseries come upon you like waves like the sea, in a continual succession. Job's messengers came thick and close one after another, to tell of oxen and house and camels and sons and daughters and all destroyed. Job chapter 1. Messenger upon messenger, and still with a sadder story, each one. We have diverse lusts, Titus 3:3, and therefore have need of diverse trials. In the sixth of the revelations, one horse comes after another, the white, the pale, the black, and the red. When the sluice is once opened, several judgments succeed in order. In the fourth of Amos, the prophet speaks of blasting and mildew and cleanness of teeth, pestilence and war, all these judgments one after another. So Christ threatens Jerusalem with wars and rumors of wars, and adds, there shall be famine and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places, Matthew 24, verse 7. Oh, then, stand in awe and sin not, Psalm 4. When the first brunt is over, you cannot say, the bitterness of death is past. Other judgments will have their course and turn. And learn, too, or also from hence, that God has several methods of trial: confiscation, banishment, poverty, infamy, reproach. Some trials search us more than others. We must leave it to His wisdom to make choice. Will suffering is as bad as will worship. Or suffering based on our own desires is as bad as worshiping our own will. I believe that's what that says. In observation 6, from that word temptations, observe that the afflictions of God's people are but trials. He calls them not afflictions or persecutions, but temptations, from the end or purpose for which God sends them. The same word is elsewhere used, 2 Peter 2:9, God knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptation. Now, affliction is called temptation not in the vulgar sense, as temptation is put for an occasion or inducement to sin, but in its proper and native signification, as it is taken for trial and experience. And so we have it positively asserted that this is the end or purpose of God. Deuteronomy 8:16, He fed thee with manna in the wilderness to humble thee and prove thee and do thee good at the latter end. The afflictions of the saints are not judgments, but corrections or trials, God's discipline to mortify sin, or His means to discover grace, to prove our faith, love, patience, sincerity, constancy, etc. Well then, behave yourself as one under trial. Let nothing be discovered in you but what is good and gracious. Men will do their best at their trial. Oh, watch over yourselves with the more care that no impatience, vanity, murmuring, or worldliness of spirit may appear in you. All right, that's the end of verse 2 of chapter 1. Lord willing, we'll start verse 3 next time. But until then, go in God's patience, and Lord willing, we'll talk to you again soon.